Well, it's called The Field. Our guest is Lynn McTaggart. We'll be back with Lynn in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Lynn McTaggart, our guest. Lynn, about a year or so ago, my daughter had to have a disc removed from her neck, and they replaced it with a cadaver donor bone. I mean, it was very scary for us, tense moments.
Wow.
She's fine now, but she was having, after the operation, after the transplant, strange dreams. I mean, bizarre dreams. She was convinced she was picking up something from that donor bone.
Well, this is not strange. I mean, this has been cataloged with a couple of scientists. People have discovered that who are undergoing transplants they in many cases develop a different personality. They start. There are a number of instances where. One guy who was, I think he was a classical musician, suddenly got interested in pop music and rock music, and he'd been interested in health food before that, and suddenly he was eating Big Macs. And it turned out that he had had a teenage donor who was a teenage girl. And there was a case recently of a guy with a kidney transplant who was a big tough guy who started acting like a woman. So these have led a lot of researchers to ask the question: when you transplant the heart, do you transplant the personality too?
And that's very possible.
Well, it seems to be the case with a lot of the evidence that we're seeing now, that it's again this whole idea that that our personality is not and our consciousness isn't confined to our brain, but that it's something that permeates our bodies, and that when a part of our body is transferred, that consciousness is transferred with it.
Who else is doing research in this area?
Well, Gary Schwartz has been doing a lot of research, mm-hmm. and certainly the HeartMath people have been looking at it because they were looking at the heart transplants and thinking and the research that's been done most recently has said that the most usual situation occurs with a heart transplant, but as your daughter discovered, it can occur with a bone, it can occur with a kidney, as it did recently, and it's a number of different organs like this. And as I say, it suggests that our consciousness is not dying. The evidence is too, and the anecdotal evidence is too profound. There's just too many cases of this.
Some of the best Hollywood movies have to do with transplants like that, and then people picking up feelings from the donor. And in some cases, scary feelings from the past donors.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't there this? There was not only the Grams one, but there was this other one that's called something like Watch for Me or something like that, which was very much about that. And it's, you know, as I say, it's a real entity. It's definitely gone on.
What about Konstantin Korotkov? Tell me about him.
Well, I think what's fascinating about him is the fact that he's been doing a lot of this work on with this GDV machines, and he's been looking at the light coming off of people in a number of circumstances. And I think what's really fascinating is he finds that the light differs depending on whether or not you're ill or well or whatever. And now in Russia, of course, he's Russian, they're using this kind of photography they take the picture of athletes and they take pictures of their fingers to see whether or not they're ready to do whatever athletic event they're training for. And the information, the light coming off their fingers, Korotkov claims, can tell us what, you know, whether they are ready.
Coming.
The other interesting thing that he's doing is finding, he's really backing up Cleve Baxter. At last, we have somebody to back up that guy who's been working for 40 years
great work that he's been doing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Cleve has been fantastic, and he's been out there on his own looking at this emotional relationship between humans and plants. And I'm sure your listeners remember that he is a famous lie detector expert, and he showed that plants are able to detect these injurious thoughts, you know, bad thoughts from people or even good thoughts from people. And Krotkoff has repeated these experiments, but instead of using the lie detector equipment, he's been able to use GVD or GDV, and he's reported the same results. What happened was he was they were measuring leaves in a potted plant in a room, and people were asked to have, you know, to have different kinds of emotions, and they found sort of measurable changes in this bioelectrographic activity of the plants, the things that were he was able to measure up from their leaves, the light coming off the leaves. And these emissions were different for each emotion. So if the plant was exposed to some sort of dangerous intention, the energy field went down. And when the intentions were positive, like when people came to the plant, you know, and had a pot of water to pour over it, or came with a smile, the energy field of the plant increased. So, I mean, I think this is extraordinary evidence that what's going on in the world is this constant little energy dance of influence between everything. And that there's this, you know, it's like what Yoda says, you feel a disturbance in the force when something bad happens. Like if something dies in the room, even if it's a goldfish or something, a plant on the other side of the room registers it.
Obviously, you believe this field was created probably at the same time the universe was created.
Well, I mean, there's theories about this, too, from scientists who believe that the field really, you know, happened from the Big Bang. I think the field was is the alpha and omega of everything, and that it was there, you know, and it is the thing that created the universe.
You see, I'll still never understand, Lynn, the theory of the Big Bang, because my little brain can't comprehend that there was nothing before it happened. And I tell you what, it's something that'll make you go crazy if you try to figure it out, because I can't.
Yeah, where did it all come from? One big explosion and then everything happened. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, really.
No, I mean, the simple way is to become extremely spiritual about this and not have to deal with it scientifically and just say God created all of it and that's the way it is. But then when you start to think of it beyond that, it just, you know, like you said, that it, you know, the field was created when the universe was created. I mean, what was there before?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, if you look at, let's go to religious sources, God said, let there be light, you know, and light is another way of talking about the field. It's the 0-point electromagnetic field. Because there's many different kinds of fields, and the zero-point field that really we talk about is kind of a mothership of fields that carries every kind of energy source. But even if you just look at it on an electromagnetic scale, in that field, it's a field of light. It's a sea of light. So you could say that you can kind of combine the religious and the scientific view. I think one of the problems with things like the Big Bang, just like with, you know, with evolution, is, you know, science is a process, and you understand a little tiny bit of something, and then you understand a little tiny bit of it, you know, a little later, and that tends to negate oftentimes or alter your view of what you originally thought. And at this moment of time, scientists think about the Big Bang. No doubt in 50 years or 100 years' time, people are going to laugh at that and say there was something much more significant and subtle going on.
You know, I'm beginning to think that this universe may create itself You know, we talk about it being 14 billion years old and that eventually they say it's going to die out. I have a feeling it does die out, but then it rejuvenates itself and everything that was gone, I mean everything, our planets and other galaxies, everything starts all over again. And I have a feeling now, Lynn, that as strange as this theory may sound, I think that we're dealing with something that could be trillions and trillions of years old, in that it's a constant replenishing. I mean, it goes through this cycle, and then it starts all over again. And, you know, when you said, let there be light, I think that happens over and over again, but over a period of, you know, incredible years.
I think that there's no question that that we have only a tiny glimmer of understanding of how we work and how the universe works. And I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happened. More of an idea of something, a giant circle rather than an arrow. And as I say, everything in our understanding and our metaphoric representation of the way the world works always represents it as an arrow. And I think that the native cultures are much closer to it, and they always believe in renewal and circularity, and would much agree with what you have to say.
Do you think if we understand the science of the field, we might be able to time travel?
Well, there's a lot of people trying this. I mean, I think Anton Zeilinger is a guy who's he runs a real frontier of the frontier quantum group in Vienna. And I mean, they've actually done this in the sense that they've sent one particle, one place, back to another place. And they've been able to move one thing instantaneously to another place. And certainly a lot of the scientists looking at the problems with time think that, you know, it might be possible to do something like this if we can manipulate the field. And the guys like Hal Puthoff and Bernie Hage, while not working on time travel, have believed that it is theoretically possible. There's nothing to suggest that you can't. And if you can learn to manipulate relativity, and that's what they're looking at, mm-hmm. to take zero-point energy and to try to tap it for space travel. The best way they're looking at it is by sort of space-time engineering, basically. Now, if they can manage to do that with space, they can probably do it with time.
There's no question if we've been visited by extraterrestrials with an unconventional propulsion system, they have tapped into the field because they know what it's all about.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what NASA and all these groups are looking into zero-point energy as the next great white hope, because we can't, with our current technology, we would need a rocket as large as the sun to travel to the next galaxy. You've got to do something besides fossil fuel. And zero-point energy is, as a lot of people call it, a cosmic free lunch, because if you can just tap into this teeming, just inordinate energy in empty space, you can just constantly, you've got a self-renewing, cheap, and non-polluting way of travel. And no doubt, alternative and, you know, alien populations have worked that one out.
I think it was William Reich who once believed that there was something called orgon in the universe. He tried to tap into that, too. They stopped him. Nikola Tesla tried to tap into what was in the universe. It seems, Lynn, that when people, scientists or researchers, try to get close to whatever it is up there, somebody stops them.
There's no question. I mean, all the guys that are in the field and all the guys that I've been talking to in my current research, so many of them have been declared as heretics and they've been persecuted by the conventional scientific community. It's quite shocking what happens to these guys. And they're just normal scientists with very good inquiring minds who are just sort of saying, okay, if my research takes me to a place I didn't expect I was going to go, I'm going to follow that thread. And that's what scientists are supposed to be.
Ah, but it doesn't happen that way all the time.
Oh, no. I mean, Jacques Benvenista, I mean, was persecuted by Nature. He's the guy who developed cellular communication between cells. And Fritz Popp, who discovered that light was coming out of the body, I mean, brilliant German physicist. And he was treated like a criminal for years. And, you know, on and on. Most of these guys have to keep their heads down and pretend that they're just working on the orthodoxy and confirming the worldview.
Do you believe psychics are tapping into the field? Good ones,
yeah.
Real ones?
Oh, yeah. I think anybody who's doing any kind of real psychic is definitely tapping into a field. They are picking up information that's outside of space and time, and outside of our conventional views of space and time, and they're just picking up some information that exists somewhere else and out there in the field. But as I say, I mean, this is not as arcane and weird. It's not just for gifted people. I don't know if you heard about this one study, but I kind of like this study when we talk about time and going back to change the past. There was a guy called Lev Avicii who is... he's a real skeptic, and he hates alternative medicine. And this was meant to show how ridiculous alternative medicine is and how you can't demonstrate science through it, that you can't use the scientific method to study it. And what he did was he had a bunch of patients in hospital who had sepsis, which is, you know, blood infection, mm-hmm. potentially fatal. And he had someone pray for all of them to get better. And he discovered that the patients were, you know, who were prayed for, and he had a brilliantly constructed double-blind study. The patients who were prayed for got better. The patients who were not prayed for, more of them died, or more of them got, they spent longer in hospital, I think it was. Well, the trick of the study was that the people who had been in the hospital were in the sort of early 90s, and the prayer went on in 2000. So he was, the prayer was going on something like 8 to 10 years after these people had been out of the hospital. But when he looked at the studies, lo and behold, the people who had been prayed for got better faster, much faster than the people who were not. And so he thought this was supposed to show how ludicrous using scientific method with alternative medicine is. But many other consciousness researchers out there, because the study was published in The Lancet, and the people who read it, consciousness researchers, people like Larry Dossey, said, well, you know, this is just a perfect example of the fact that, you know, prayer, retro prayer works.
Well, go ahead.
Where does that leave us with the idea of time? You know, we realize that, you know, this opens up a lot of possibilities. If we are able to get the technology together, time travel should be simple because time is an illusion.
Yet people believe that consciousness and prayer worked 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, yes. Well, they were closer to it than we are with a lot of our conventional medicine, you know, 80% of which has never been proven.
And a lot of people think that prayer, you're talking about religion. That's not the case. You're talking about tapping into what is out there.
Well, you know, the field isn't anti-religion. I mean, my view is not anti-religious because it's just a different word. If we get away from the idea that God is a little man or a man with a long white beard sitting up there on a cloud, and we think of God as an absolute, well, you could say the field is being in the field as being in a state of grace. You could use any kind of terminology. But prayer isn't just praying to God. It is praying. And certainly many studies have shown this, that no matter what kind of prayer you use, whether it's praying to Star Woman, you know, if you're Native American, or praying to Jesus if you're Christian, or praying to anybody, that prayer works. Prayer, using an intention, asking the universe to help something, works.
Stay with us. Lynn McTaggart, our guest. We'll come right back. We'll talk about the field and how it equates to you taking care of your health, and then phone calls at the top of the hour. We'll be back. And we'll continue our discussion with Lynn McTaggart. And then next hour, why don't we open up the phone lines? We'll give you an opportunity to talk with her. We'll be back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. And And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, our guest, Lynn McTaggart. Lynn, let's talk a little bit about the alternative health field that you have also gone into, and in what direction have you taken that?
Well, I mean, what we started out looking at conventional medicine, and and looking at the medical literature to see what works in conventional medicine, and we discovered that so much of what we consider established, standard medical procedure, standard operating procedure, is dangerous and unproven. And so, of course, that led us to alternative medicine. And we found, that you can discriminate. There are some things that work and some things that are absolute hokum. I think that more alternative medicine works by far than conventional medicine for anything other than acute conditions. If I get run over today by a truck, I want modern medicine to put me back together again. Mm-hmm. Believe me, the best of and the most forward thinking of modern medicine. But for just about anything else, the chronic condition, alternative medicine works. But certain things work better than others. And many, many products work and many products don't work. So that's some of what we do, too. We test that.
Now, when you say some work, some don't, why is that? Is it because they're inferior, or perhaps the individual doesn't believe in it? What creates that?
Well, I think certain things work better for certain things. I mean, I think a lot of the old and established mechanisms, like homeopathy, is brilliant. I mean, it works for just about everything. And if you can get the right homeopath and the right homeopathic remedy, it works fantastically. It's difficult because there's something like 700 remedies. You need a very smart homeopath to match you and your remedy up together. But when you do, it's wonderful. I've got my youngest daughter, who's 9, is home and has been home with the flu for the past 3 days. And every time I'm on the phone with my homeopathic pharmacist, and every time she's got one or another symptom, I tell him about it, and he tells me what remedy to give her, and that symptom goes away. And I've found it with members of our family, where my big girl had a big important interview for a school and had the flu also, and she was really couldn't get up, really sick. And so again, I gave her the homeopathic stuff that my homeopath told her, and she was up and had that interview and was chirpy, and it was like night and day in 24 hours. It was absolutely amazing.
I assume they didn't get flu shots, did they?
No. That's another subject. Flu shots are dangerous and they don't work. And the main reason they don't work is that you can only look backwards with a flu shot. You can only work out a flu formula based on your best guess of what bugs are going to be in that around that year. And usually they try to work it out from what's happened last year. But, viruses and bacteria are very smart little microbes, and they're able to mutate very easily. And so the flu shots for any particular year, usually will only catch a minority of what's out there. And certainly everybody's very worried about avian flu, but the shot they've got ready for it, and a lot of people have taken in preparedness, won't work for it. And even the official bodies have said it won't work.
Well, you've brought up bird flu. I don't think it's going to turn into a pandemic, Lynn. As a matter of fact, they had a doctor on Oprah Winfrey today. And, this guy said it's definitely happening. He panicked her audience. I don't think it's going to happen.
No, I mean, we did a story on it, and we certainly don't either. I mean, it looks like the only cases of it are really people who have had a lot of contact with poultry. It doesn't look like there's huge animal-to-human transmission. And if you look at a lot of the big hysterical problems we were supposed to have, SARS was the last one. I mean, every so often, I think epidemics are when people get stupid. And I think certainly governments are stupid when they start throwing out drugs like flu shots that they themselves know won't work for avian flu, just to try to appease people's fears, basically.
Well, you know, and then there are reports, you know, 5 people die here, 10 people die here, and you know what? That's sad for them and their families, but to be honest, that's not a lot of people for what should be a pandemic.
Well, we don't panic about the flu. You know, we know, and the flu kills hundreds of and thousands of people.
Well, CDC says 36,000 people a year. I think that's an inflated number, by the way.
Well, I think it's an inflated number. I mean, we've seen that with, I know this goes on. I saw this myself in the UK with meningitis. They released a meningitis shot for a certain kind of meningitis. And, you know, listen, nobody would want to, you know, everybody's worried about meningitis, of course, for kids. And I certainly wouldn't want to mess with it. But it was for meningitis C. And they were sort of talking about these incredible figures about how dangerous this stuff, this thing was and how common among children. So I called up the Department of Statistics and I said, okay, year by year, how many kids have died from this? And it turned out that something like 50 kids had died from all ages of this meningitis C. And yet they were going to give this completely untried and untested vaccine to every kid up until the age of 16. And I worked out the statistics and I figured out that your kid was about 8 times more likely to drown in his bathtub than get meningitis C. So, you know, it's that kind of ludicrous idea that usually is behind these, you know, hysterias. And you have to look at the fact that the shot itself is going to have a lot of dangers. And so you really have to weigh up the benefits versus the risks. And if the risks are minuscule, then there's no benefit to taking the shot.
What's going on with this staph infection that doctors are telling me is a serious problem? We're working on a full program on this. Staph infection in the United States, a lot of people get it in hospitals, but it's out there. And, I mean, people will go in with you know, like a cut, come down with this staph infection, Lynn, they end up dying.
Well,
it's incredible.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about going into the hospital and getting
primarily,
it.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is that hospitals are about the most unsafe place in the universe to be when you're ill. The last place you want to be is in the hospital because you're going to catch just about anything there. I mean, I give you a horrible example. My Christmas reading was the Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. I'm a great fan. Her daughter had a fever of 103. She worries. She goes to the hospital. Her daughter's 37. She suddenly completely develops blood sepsis, you know, total body infection. And her parents can't figure out what was supposedly a flu had turned into what seemed to be pneumonia and suddenly an entire body of infection. She's unconscious. She's there for 6 weeks. So she develops pulmonary thrombosis. You know, she gets a blood clot to her lungs. They give her anti-clotting medication, and she gets out. She's on a plane. She goes to California for a holiday, and she collapses on the tarmac and has with a stroke, bleeding in the brain, uncontrolled because of the anticoagulants. And eventually, she dies. This is a year and a half later. But the point was that she had a hospital-acquired infection, hospital-acquired thrombosis, and hospital-acquired bleeding to the brain. And it all started with a fever that wasn't very serious, that maybe just should have been allowed to ride its course, because fever is good. Fever is what the body does when you're ill. It kills the infection.
It burns it off, I guess,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. And there's no threshold.
You just don't want it to get too high.
Sorry?
You just don't want a fever that gets way too high.
Well, but the thing is that we looked at this. There's no threshold. That's our common misunderstanding.
Really?
There's no threshold above which a fever automatically creates febrile seizures. You know, seizures.
Well, see, we were always told when we were raising our kids, you know, the doctor said, how high is the temperature? And you said, well, you know, it's 103, it's 104. He says, if it gets to 105, they could have seizures, convulsions. I mean, they scared the heck out of us.
They do, and there's no proof in that. We looked at all the science about that and found that when you mess with fever, people were more likely to take longer to get better. And so that whole idea that there's this threshold above which it's dangerous is a nonsense.
So you mean to tell me you have no knowledge of people dying from heavy fevers?
No, there is no danger. There's no danger with that kind of fever. Not according to the medical literature. And we just searched. It was just in our last issue.
Huh. Well, what are they dying from?
Well, they're dying from, you know, they may die from another element of the disease that, you know, their body was unable to fight the disease. The fever is the fire department. You know, the fever is the body's fire department trying to put out the fire, basically.
All right, and the higher the fever, the more the body is saying, look, this is almost out of control. We have to fight
it. Yeah, the body's trying to kill this. I mean, they found there was Coley's toxins. The guy who was working on cancer research found that if you induce a very high fever, you can sometimes kill the cancer. And so high fever has been used as a cancer treatment in the past. So it's, you know, this is our great myth. But getting back to those whole infection idea is, you know, what's happened is we've unleashed this monster by indiscriminate uses of antibiotics. You know, we have created mutations that we can no longer control.
We can't fight them off. You're absolutely right. We don't have the antibiotics for them.
Yeah, exactly. The antibiotics won't work. I mean,
it's almost what we've done in the insect world. You know, we have created so many pesticides to kill insects that they're immune to some of them now.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and you know, this is the way of things. I mean, you know, living creatures, living microbes, mutate to survive, and they are now realizing, you know, that doctors are realizing that with a lot of these hospital-acquired infections, they will throw 3 and 4 of the most powerful antibiotics on the planet at them and can't do anything about them. So it's important to to be, you know, to trust your own process before going to a situation where, you know, that you may not need. So you have to really ask yourself before going into a hospital, basically.
I used to think that this quick outpatient craze was just insurance companies, and I'm beginning to think that maybe it has to do with that, and they want to get you out of that hospital, or, you know, because they don't want you to come down with something else.
Exactly. But, you know, a lot of this idea can really fill all of us with huge fear, like, oh, my God, we can't go to the hospital anymore. But, you know, there is so much great alternative medicine out there that really does the trick and really works well. I mean, all the ancient things that we were talking about before, homeopathy, acupuncture, herbs, so many good herbs that people understand now work for things. And we're always finding so many treatments, so many ways of treating things that don't need to require, you know, heavy drugs and surgery.
But you're not opposed to some mainstream medicine, right?
I'm not opposed for it for the right reasons. I mean, as I say, if it's an acute condition, nothing better than emergency medicine. I mean, the high-tech medicine is unbelievable. It's brilliant.
Well, I mean, like, you know, someone has high blood pressure and has tried to lose weight, has tried to exercise, can't get it down, and so the doctor puts him on a blood pressure pill, and he's down now, and he's healthy. I mean, is that okay?
I think it's pretty benign. I mean, that, you know, like a water pill or something like that is pretty benign and not bad. I guess I feel that there are so many easy ways and easier ways of bringing down blood pressure or say lowering cholesterol. I mean, we just recently did a story looking at clogged arteries and, you know, atherosclerosis, and seeing new evidence connecting it with a big deficiency of vitamin C. So it could well be that people suffering from this problem are really, it's kind of an advanced form of scurvy. It's what Linus Pauling was going on about a long time ago. And they found that, you know, you can take high doses, I'm talking about high doses of vitamin C, like
thousands of milligrams, yeah.
Yeah, and that you can reverse this. There have been some evidence of being able to reverse this. So I guess what I'm saying is it's not a bad last call, modern medicine, but there's a lot of more effective ways. Just taking down your GI count, just lowering your glycemic intake of foods can normalize your cholesterol. That's a simple approach, and maybe easier and safer than taking statins. So, we're always looking at safer alternatives and always taking the position that, if you can do something else besides taking a drug, it's probably safer.
So how does this also equate to trying to tap into the field for people who have an ability to heal themselves?
Okay, well, this is all of a piece, because if you look at medicine is still built on this whole separate Cartesian model of mind being very different from body. But there is so much evidence out there that mind and consciousness can be tapped to heal. I mean, so much evidence of distant healing working, so much evidence of homeopathy working. Now, homeopathy, as your listeners probably know, is a situation where you're just dealing with water. You're dealing with diluting a substance so much that you have none of that initial substance left. This is why medicine can't get their minds around it. Now, that's using water as a carrier of information, of subatomic information, and yet it works. There's huge studies showing it works. So there's an example of the field in action. Or acupuncture. They're now finding that acupuncture, they've just done a study over here in the UK showing acupuncture lights up certain parts of the brain. It dulls the pain mechanism, which would demonstrate why you can operate on somebody without anesthesia, just sticking some acupuncture needles in them. And they're also finding that the chakras of the body are at a higher energy level, the meridians of the body at a higher energy level. This goes along with what, with the masters were speaking about thousands of years ago.
Wouldn't it be something if these acupuncture needles were just really little antennae and they pulled in this energy from the universe, from the field?
Well, it well could be, George, because this is Bill Tiller has found that acupuncture points and meridians are at a higher gauge state. They are at a different level of reality than the rest of the body. So how's that for a little antennae?
That's a lot. Well, stay with us, Lynn. I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to open up the phone lines when we come back. Tell me very quickly about this conference you have coming up.
Well, it's called Icons of the Field, and we decided to put together everybody who was anybody in the field, and that includes Hal Puthoff, who really first discovered it, and Carl Pribram, who's the inventor of the holographic universe, Gary Schwartz, who's done that transplant work and the afterlife, Bill Tiller, who's done all these wonderful black box experiments, Konstantin Korotkov, and Pim Van Lommel, who's done some fabulous stuff on near-death experiences. And so we felt this is kind of a one-off situation, which we're running on March 18th and 19th, to get all these guys together on the same podium.
And where's that going to be again?
It's in London, and you can see all of it on our website. But I think it's going to be exciting, because we know Konstantin is actually going to show, through his Curlian photography computerized stuff, how people's thoughts can affect other people. We're going to do a lot of this in real time right there at the conference.
How long have you lived in London?
Nearly 20 years.
How come you don't have an accent?
I hold on to my Americanism
with great force. And pride, I trust.
I do.
All right, stay with us, Lynn. We're going to open up the phone lines. Final hour to go with you. We'll give you an opportunity to talk with her about, zero-point field, alternative health. You've heard what we've talked about. Now it's your turn. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.